Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, decidedly not Field of Dreams' wife.
And I'm Dan Webster, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that's been continuously on the air since 1999, which means we've never had a sequel, requel, revival, reboot, or franchise spinoff. But those are the sorts of movies we'll be talking about this week, because every few months, Hollywood brings a decades-old cultural property back from the dead. 2026 alone sees the release of The Devil Wears Prada 2, 20 years after the original film, a sixth entry in the Scary Movie spoof series, bringing an end to its 13-year hiatus, the unfortunately titled Focker-in-Law, the first Meet the Parents sequel in 16 years, The Social Reckoning, Aaron Sorkin's follow-up to the Oscar-winning 2010 film The Social Network, and that's only scratching the surface. There are many more examples in film and TV. But let's first get clear on some distinctions. A legacy sequel is one that revives a long-dormant series or franchise, brings back some or all of the original cast and or creators, and is sold to the public on brand recognition and nostalgia. For example, 2003's The Matrix Reloaded, released just 4 years after the first film, does not count as a legacy sequel, but 2021's The Matrix Resurrections, released 17 years after its most immediate predecessor, does. So, with that not at all confusing groundwork laid, I just want to ask, one, what do we make of this trend? Two, where do we think it's coming from? And three, is it possible for a legacy sequel to be anything more than a marketing ploy?
For that last question, I got to say, yeah, it is possible, but it depends on who is directing the film and what the project is trying to make out of a screenplay. Mm-hmm. Is it a decent screenplay? Is it just going to be a retread of the first film, or is it going to try to go in a new direction? It is possible. Unfortunately, many of the ones, and Nathan, I appreciate the fact that you gave us a list. There must be two dozen films here
and
on this list.
And it's not even complete.
Yeah,
there were
no,
ones
it's
I
not
thought
even
of later that I forgot.
Of all those, I was only able to find three of them that I think are really good films. The rest of them are all just, well, you know, we've got a proven product here. So if we do it again, some people will go out and see it. So if we don't have to spend a lot of money, which we won't because we'll get some jerk screenwriter to give us a retread. And then, you know, so just so many of these movies are bad.
You know, I'm pushing back against the concept and the distinctions that you laid out there. And anybody who's ever been in an Aquafit class with me knows that I sometimes do my own thing.
Or taking a law school class from you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that, you know, there is some blurring of these lines to some extent, because we were talking about if you do something that is based on the original film but doesn't necessarily share all the characters. If somebody's missing, for example, in American Graffiti, does that count? If Richard Dreyfuss doesn't show up? I don't know. So we can you know, have a spirited discussion, because I ultimately want to talk about things that we would like to see a sequel made from the original source, whereas some of these legacy sequels are just bad. I mean, I'm sorry. I've always liked Bridget Jones' character, for example. And Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy, I couldn't even finish it. And that may be one of the rare times I have not finished a movie.
Well, and I think that the bad legacy sequels, and I agree with you that most of them are, they're the ones that are totally reliant on reverence to the original work. They're not interrogating the original or commenting on its cultural impact over the years or pushing it in new directions. They're just referencing things that happened in the first film or the most recent film and expecting us to clap like trained seals because we recognize them. They're doing it again.
And the implicit question here is, why do they do this? And it's because they're risk averse.
They
want to retread exactly what they've done before. And
because it was successful before in most cases.
Right, exactly.
And because nostalgia is king.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm into nostalgia.
Sure.
The film journalist Stephen Gatos writing in the Guardian, quoted Gil Scott-Heron. I love this quote. "Americans want to go back as far as they can, even if it turns out to be only last week, not to face now or the future, but to face backwards."
Ah, Gil. Yeah.
And you know, and even when you look at films such as Sinners and F1, those are huge films that were successful in certain ways, but they all had earmarks of films that had come before. They were derivative. And I quoted one movie veteran, who says, "Truly original, provocative, mainstream drama which deals in recognizable human dilemmas no longer has a place in cinemas." I don't know that that's necessarily true, but it's at your multiplex and your Dolby and your IMAX. That's
so
absolutely
American
true.
Movies?
Yes.
Well, and there's, of course, a difference between original directorial visions that are still hearkening back to things that came before, are explicitly referencing earlier movies and tropes. I mean, somebody like Quentin Tarantino has made an entire career out of
correct.
That. But he still
and
puts
he acknowledges
a,
that.
Yes, and he still puts a personal stamp on things. I think when we're talking about the bad legacy sequels, we're talking about movies that basically feel like expanded Super Bowl commercials. Mm-hmm. You know how Super Bowl commercials are now all about bringing back, like, say, Jeff Bridges to play the dude from Big Lebowski
again? Or
even
the Chevrolet theme song is back to the original from the 50s
sure,
or 60s.
Yeah.
Well, don't you think that even in the realm of sequels themselves, they're running out of material? So they've got to go back to these films that were 15, 20 years, 25 years old to find fresh, quote-unquote, material.
And the worst examples of these, I think, are the comedy legacy sequels. And we've
what,
reviewed
Happy
a few.
Gilmore too?
Well, that's one of them. I mean, I think they're the most guilty of all the things that we've talked about, because most of the time, they're just repeating the same jokes and catchphrases from the earlier ones, but they're doing it at a louder volume and with a bigger budget. So you've got Anchorman 2, Zoolander 2, Coming to America, Happy Gilmore 2. They all did this. And in the case of Happy Gilmore 2, they just included entire scenes from the original movie. And it feels so lazy. You just keep thinking, we could have gotten something fresh and new, but instead they're just reheating leftovers.
Well, and the problem is, we talked about this when we reviewed Happy Gilmore 2. I mean, there were some funny things, but it was only known to the cognoscenti. So if you follow golf, you could appreciate, but that doesn't make it work for general audiences. So, you know, if you have people who hate each other paired together, you know, as players throughout
funny.
This film, right, it was funny. Or somebody who never speaks all of a sudden becomes the spokesperson.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, so this has to work. You know, if you're appealing to a broad-based audience, then you know, you don't want to have some sort of, you know, very niche kind of film.
Yeah, it's risk-averse. Well, we've talked about the bad. Maybe we can talk about the handful of good legacy sequels, because I think we're in agreement on, in this big, long list of legacy sequels that we've got in front of us, the best ones.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you have to give somebody like George Miller credit. I mean, George Miller started out as basically a Wes Craven kind of guy who just made movie with a bunch of motorcycles. And I mean, it's Mad Max. The original Mad Max is a terrific film.
Yeah.
And you go all these years later, Mad Max Fury Road. That's an arrogant, overwhelming, amazing visual movie.
And made 30 years after the previous
exactly.
Mad Max movie. I also would call out Blade Runner 2049.
Me too. That's one of my faves.
Which came out, you know, 35, 36 years after the 1982 original. I think what makes those two distinct, and I think why you see them listed as, you know, the best of these kinds of movies, is because they each had their own directorial vision, irrespective of their predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not just brand extensions. I mean, they are to an extent, because they probably got bankrolled because, oh, people know what Mad Max and Blade Runner are. But they've got these visions that feel fresh, that feel new. You don't have to have seen the others, especially in the case of Mad Max Fury Road, to really get into the drama and the style.
Okay, so here's where I started to get confused about legacy sequels. So, for example, The Color of Money was obviously based on The Hustler.
Yeah.
But Tom Cruise wasn't in the original. I mean, Charlize Theron was not in the original Mad Max Fury Road.
Only so, Paul Newman.
Right. This is where I thought the lines became blurred in your categorization, because does it have to be complete? You know, how far can you deviate from the original? Silence of the Lambs, you know, was a successor to Manhunter. But does that count at all?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
And I'll...
Okay,
I'll,
this,
I'll,
is the, this is the legacy sequel
because,
definition according to Nathan
well,
Weinbender.
Well, because those were two completely different casts.
Well, and I'll respond to you in a way that you'll understand, just like the Supreme Court did, which is, I don't have a great definition, but I know one when I see one.
Oh, thank you, Potter so, yeah. Stewart. Yes.
Okay. Well, that was the first half of this special show about the ongoing phenomenon of legacy sequels. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Dan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to continue the discussion. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Brendan McMurphy, sales manager at Spokane Public Radio. Our listeners crave all things local. Local news, music, arts, and culture. And they love to support local business. Program underwriting with SPR is a win-win. Your business support sustains public radio while we connect you with our audience. To learn more about business support or to become a program underwriter, email me at underwriting@kpbx.org. And thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Nathan Weinbender. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Dan Webster, and I were talking about legacy sequels, the good and, more often than not, the bad. Where did we leave off? Dan, I think you had something you wanted to
exactly.
add.
Exactly. When you were talking about the good, the one that we didn't mention was 28 Years Later by Danny Boyle, which picks up on the notion, the idea, the conceit of the first one, but goes in a completely different direction. And it updates everything and has terrific performances.
Yes.
But it's Danny Boyle, as you point out. I mean, he's the creator of it. And
him and Alex Garland came back for that. And
absolutely.
I will say, 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, which came out just like 6 months after that one, is also worth checking out. So that's a good call out. Something I wanted to do on this show, and I challenged you with this prompt before we recorded, is thinking about movies that we would actually like to see get long-awaited legacy sequels, because we spent a lot of the show talking about legacy sequels we didn't like and probably didn't want. So I was curious if there are any movies that probably aren't going to in reality get a legacy sequel anytime soon, but you would actually like to see one. So MP, I'll throw it to you.
Okay. Groundhog Day, LOL.
Oh, good one.
I mean, I'm partially joking about that, but
I
at the same time,
idea.
You know, yeah, I mean, but we would have to bring back some of the original cast. And so here's one of the problems with these legacy sequels. You know, just as we've emphasized to you, Nathan, not everyone's going to be around forever. So that's why
that
you
was
have
news to me.
Oh, you have to bring them back quickly sometimes. But the other one that I picked out really was Galaxy Quest. We've talked about that repeatedly, but you could totally focus on the kids who were helping out the main cast members in that particular film. And Tim Allen's still around, Sigourney Weaver's still around, Sam Rockwell's still around.
Unfortunately, Alan Rickman's
not.
I know,
he's not.
Heartbreak. Yeah. What about you, Dan?
Well, I went back even further. Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
Mm. Russell Crowe's still around, kind of.
Exactly. Well, it's from 2003, and I always thought that there should have been Patrick O'Brien. They're based upon the novels of Patrick O'Brien, and he's got about 20 of them.
Right.
So you should have been able to find another story, and I think they tried to work on it, but Peter Weir was never a franchise director. Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany at that time, 2003 in the early 2000s, they were both hot properties. So unfortunately, it never got made, but it is one of the best seafaring movies ever made. It's a terrific film.
And even the way the title is set up, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, makes it seem like they named it that way so that they could add more sequels to it. So it could be Master and Commander, another subtitle. So
right,
they were
exactly.
clearly setting it up for a franchise,
yeah.
and it just never
yeah.
happened. I think people are still waiting mm-hmm. for the Master and Commander sequel. That's a good one.
So what about you?
Well, I'll throw one out. And I've definitely brought this movie up on this show before, but I would love to see a legacy sequel to Almost Famous from 2000. Mm. Cameron Crowe's Oscar-winning script about his own time as a teenage writer for Rolling Stone in the early
1970s. I thought it was Song Sung Blue. Wasn't that a legacy sequel?
I don't think it was. I don't think it was.
Never mind. Still confused.
The reason I picked it is that Crowe's career, because it's semi-autobiographical, his career continued past the era that he dramatized in Almost Famous, and he kept writing about music long before he ever started making movies. And I recently read his memoir, which just came out, The Uncool, which mostly focuses on the same time frame as Almost Famous, but it has so many more stories that he didn't get into this movie. For example, there's a whole section in the book about a year, year and a half that young Cameron Crowe spent with David Bowie during his Berlin period, where he was alienated and paranoid and on a lot of drugs. And I think at one point, Crowe even lived in his California guest house and just spent all this time with Bowie. And that alone,
I would see that for sure.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, not everyone from the original Almost Famous is around. I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and miss him every day.
And what is the strange sequence there, the coincidence there? Philip Seymour Hoffman played Lester Bangs.
Yep.
Both of them died from a drug overdose.
Yes, sadly. And legendary performance. But Frances McDormand, Kate Hudson, mm-hmm. Billy Crudup, they're all still around. Maybe it doesn't even need to focus on the same characters. Just have that central idea of Cameron Crowe looking back on his life. Right. So that's one for you.
Well, Nathan, you and I were kind of joking around a little bit because Dan and I recently visited the Field of Dreams filming location in
right.
Iowa, hence my introduction. And Dan and I continually joke about Field of Dreams' wife because in this movie, Amy Madigan, playing the wife, is forced to keep it all together, the family farm, the kids, when Kevin Costner, her husband in the film, is going to build this baseball field 100 yards from their house. And so when we visited that place, I said to you, oh, I'd like to see a legacy sequel from these characters.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Amy Madigan just won an Academy Award.
Yes.
And that's when you said, oh, there is a sequel because Amy Madigan turned into Aunt Gladys in
Weapons.
Watching her husband build that baseball diamond just drove her to witchcraft.
Well, and my prediction was that she was going to show up on one of those murder shows because, you know, at some point she was bound to get fed up with being Field of Dreams'
wife. You mean she was going to snap?
Right, exactly.
You want a Field of Dreams too, but you want it to be like more of a thriller.
I guess. And hey, there are enough sports scandals going on these days.
That's
that
true.
They could definitely, you know.
If you build it, she will snap.
That's the subtitle. Dan, do you have another legacy sequel you want
to
see?
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite Pixar Disney movies is WALL-E. And WALL-E would be an easy fix. It's animated.
Yeah.
So you just bring Andrew Stanton, the director, back on the screen, co-screenwriter, and then you've got all the characters. And so, you know, what it could be is, you know, the humans have come back to Earth. Now they're rebuilding Earth, but they have to rebuild the Earth with the two robots, Eve and WALL-E. And it's just one of my favorite of those movies. It's one that I could watch again and again and again.
Well, and we've seen Pixar do this with long delayed sequels to their earlier hits. I mean, we had sequels to
The Incredibles,
Finding Nemo, The Incredibles, Inside Out just recently. All of those were huge hits. There are a couple of those early Pixar masterpieces that they haven't made sequels to. Ratatouille is one, A Bug's Life, and WALL-E. And I wonder if maybe there are certain ones that they just don't want to touch,
mm-hmm.
or if maybe there have been ideas that have been floated and they just haven't taken off. But I feel like with WALL-E, you could go in literally any direction.
Right.
He could visit any kind of planet mm-hmm. or solar system.
How about The Adventures of Tintin?
Oh, you know, that one, the Spielberg Peter Jackson movie.
Yeah.
That would be interesting because I think they thought that was going to be a way bigger hit. I think
yeah.
it's a Master and Commander situation where they thought it was going to be a huge hit and it really wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But Tintin's been around for literal decades.
Right. Yes,
they
yes,
could
yes.
easily do a sequel
well,
to that.
And I always liked that film, The Fifth Element, with
yeah.
Bruce Willis and Mila Jovovich.
Okay.
Now, Luc Besson, you know, directed that film. Bruce Willis cannot come back. She conceivably could, or the cab could just be the recurring, you know, the taxi could just be the recurring
yeah.
Cast member in the
Gary Oldman and, could
Gary
come back.
Gary Oldman's still
correct.
Around.
No,
Chris Tucker still
oh,
around.
No, unfortunately, yeah.
Okay, I have another one. This might be kind of a curveball, but this is a movie that I love that has always felt a little under the radar to me, but I think has potential for a really interesting sequel, and that's About a Boy from 2002.
Hmm.
This was based on a Nick Hornby novel directed by Chris and Paul Weitz, who also directed American Pie, mm-hmm. believe it or not. And it's got Hugh Grant in it as this idle bachelor. It's probably my favorite of his performances. And he's living off the royalties from a Christmas novelty song that his father wrote back
yeah.
in the 60s. and he unexpectedly befriends this neighborhood kid played by a very young Nicholas Holt,
right,
who's also still around. He's being bullied at school. His single mother, who's played by the great Toni Collette, is having an emotional breakdown, and they just have this very unexpected friendship. And the basic plot beats sound like cliches, and it even ends with kind of a cliched idea, which is this big talent show, mm-hmm, where one of the characters makes a big dramatic gesture to the other. But it's a really funny, really knowing movie, and it has a big heart without being cloying. And I picked it for one simple reason. I want to know what happened to these characters. Are they okay? Have they grown and changed? Are they still stuck in neutral? And I know that About a Boy was adapted into an NBC sitcom, which I never saw and which only ran for 2 seasons. So I don't count that as a legacy sequel. But I think there's a lot of potential there. And I think not a movie that's on everyone's lips all the time. So definitely not holding my breath for that one. But About a Boy.
We'll talk about movies that have characters that you want to know what happened to them. How about Cameron Crowe's Say Anything?
Yeah.
1989.
Lloyd Dobler.
John Cusack is still around. Lloyd Dobler, one of my heroes of all cinema. Let's
Ione
see.
Ione
Sky is there. John Mahoney died, but that would be perfect to go on. What happened to them after they went to London?
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, you think they're going to break up again, but maybe not. Or if they did break up again, then maybe they got together again also.
It could be like a before sunrise, before sunset kind of situation.
And Dan and I were having a spirited discussion about, can you have a legacy sequel if one of the primary characters died in the first film? Because I said, we could have a legacy sequel of Pulp Fiction. We could have a legacy sequel of The Usual Suspects, but people have been canceled forth. So I don't know.
How about a whole different idea about legacy prequels?
Oh, there we go.
I know, but because you guys had
for
a legacy
Reservoir
prequel.
Dogs. Perfect.
You had a legacy prequel when you worked for The Spokesman. Together.
Now, that's a movie everyone wants to see.
Yeah,
all right. And that was our discussion of legacy sequels, and this is Movies 101. I'm Nathan Weinbender, and earlier in the show, Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed which movies actually deserve them. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Bratt for directing the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial. We'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, no matter how long we have to wait for it. Until then, consider these words from the king of the legacy sequel, director George Miller. We are the servants of the zeitgeist, and we live in a chaotic world. Stories are a way of distilling something out of all that bombardment. They're a way of finding signal in the noise. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.